Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
COVID-19 is still very much with us, so what has it shown about Connecticut's and the U.S.'s economy? We talk with an economist from Eastern Connecticut State University about how COVID has highlighted the broken systems in this country. Plus, a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. With COVID-19 still dominating the headlines and all of our lives, it seems an apt time to take a look at the toll the pandemic has brought over the last year. Despite initiatives and stimulus payments for people and companies, COVID-19 has unwrapped how broken many systems are in the US. And depending on the color of your skin, those disparities can run even deeper. Brendan Cunningham is a professor at the Economics and Finance Department of Eastern Connecticut State University, based in Willimantic, and I spoke to him recently about the toll of COVID-19 and the state of the country generally. Professor Cunningham, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
It's a big question to start with. COVID-19 has sort of really shown us in this country how broken many systems are. How did we get to this?
I think it's probably the product of many years, maybe connected to philosophies about the role of government in society and sort of the limits and potentials of government in society as well. So, you know, I think that one of the things we maybe lost track of is that you can have these kinds of events involving public health, the national, in fact, in this case, global impact, which, you know, government is really the organization which is going to step up and, you know, address that issue during a time of crisis. I think that particularly at a national level, but perhaps even regionally, you know, we've grown accustomed to sort of accepting, let's say, certain services like police, fire, military, incarceration, right? You know, we just kind of don't question the quote-unquote need for those things, but there has been a trend towards questioning whether investments in certain things like healthcare or research and development or even education, you know, whether government should really be involved in that or whether, you know, there's a lot of value to be had there. And I think one of the most important lessons we can take from this global pandemic is that these things are critical to addressing crises as much as your, say, local fire department is, right? It was R&D and pharmaceutical labs that is getting us out of this crisis and ending it. That's a product of investment in STEM and educational systems. It's the, you know, logistical challenge associated with rolling out millions and billions of vaccinations, which, you know, the government needs to be involved with and it needs to do it well. So I think, unfortunately, there had been sort of a retrenchment in philosophy about the role of government in public health. You know, perhaps there's this notion that leave it in private hands, you know, companies and corporations will handle it. And it is true that they play a vital role in developing the vaccine and producing it. But you also need a parallel, effective governance structure to address public health crises. And it's something we're going to need to invest in the future.
Do you think that, you know, COVID really has, you know, unwrapped the disparities and, as I say, the broken nature of many systems in this country to the point that hopefully people and politicians, elected officials will give serious consideration to these things and, you know, not just put a band-aid on them, which they seem to have done in the past, but actually look more long-term as to how we change and how we make sure that situations like this, you know, either don't happen again or, you know, that they've got a way of controlling them better, because it seems that we don't seem to learn. And it was only COVID that sort of really did show us how bad it wasn't, you know, in this country. I mean, for example, food insecurity here in the state of Connecticut since COVID-19 hit has gone up 30%. I mean, that is a huge jump in food insecurity. And that's just one example.
I do think that the pandemic, you know, kind of has shown to us that these kinds of things can and do happen. So prior to what happened in this pandemic, the last time, you know, we probably saw food lines of that length. And I'm not going to say that food insecurity, you know, has been small or insignificant, but sort of massive food lines and massive food insecurity. The last time we might have been familiar with imagery of that was probably the Great Depression. But now, you know, we know that in times of crisis, you need robust public service supply of food and other services in order to make sure people can get through that kind of crisis, get to the other side of it without, you know, too much damage to themselves and their families and their communities. So I do think that we're going to take a lot of lessons from what's happened with the COVID pandemic going forward. But, you know, sometimes we tend to be a little bit too short-sighted and have a short memory of what's occurred. And I think some, you know, there are important things like presidential commissions that investigate these types of crises. We had one after 9/11, and we probably need to do the same in this case to sort of, you know, look at what we did well, look at what we did poorly. Certainly food insecurity was one of the things we didn't do very well. One thing we did a little bit better this time around was sort of the suspension of mortgage payments, which to some extent prevented a rise in homelessness, although that's certainly a issue that is still there and, you know, might start to crop up in coming months if there's no movement on policy when it comes to that. So I do think we need to take some time once we get through this crisis to look at things we could do better for the next crisis, because one of the things we know about economics is there, you know, there's always another recession or downturn out there in the future. And so with that in mind, we need to be prepared for it.
What also about the fact that there seems to be a bit of a strange attitude here in the US when it comes to one, defending the country. Money is thrown at that in every direction. And don't get me wrong, I'm not against the military. I'm not against any country, obviously, having the ability to look after itself on that level. But then when you talk about, oh, we need to increase, you know, the wage, the minimum wage in this country so people can actually live, and all hell breaks loose and people are saying, oh, no, you know, that's unacceptable. Why is there that strange sort of disconnect?
It's a great question, and it's not one that I necessarily, you know, can shed too much light on. It's sort of almost a sociological question in some ways. It is true, though, that, you know, as an economist, you know, when I look at, let's say, military expenditures and then, let's say, expenditures on healthcare, you know, to me, those are the same thing in the sense that they're both the government spending money for a service. In one case, the service is national defense. In the other case, the service is healthcare. So when I look at these things, you know, I just ask myself, okay, what are the reasons that the spending are taking place in these areas? And are those reasons sort of economically sound? In the case of national defense, we know that it's something we call a public good. And so if the government doesn't do it, no one else will. But in the case of healthcare, there's a lot of reasons to believe that that too is a public good for a variety of different reasons. And so there's economically sound reasons for the government to sort of subsidize and expand access to healthcare as well. And so unfortunately, there is, you know, my one insight in terms of sociology is that sometimes labels get thrown around like socialism, right? So for some reason, you know, spending on the military is not socialism, but spending on healthcare is. As an economist, I don't really understand that approach because at the end of the day, they're both government spending for a service. So I think, you know, the roots of this might go back many years, basically, to the Cold War and, you know, sort of the difference in philosophy regarding the government's role in society and in the economy. And I think that to some extent, we just kind of need to move forward from this sort of black and white view of the world where, you know, if the government does it, it's bad. If private companies do it, it's good. The reality is that the most successful economies in the world with the happiest people exist in the mixed economy framework, where the government provides certain services because in the absence of the government, they wouldn't be provided otherwise.
Is that an area where you think that possibly the US may, you know, potentially turn towards? Is sort of like a much more mixed approach to things? Do you see that that could be, you know, the way forward for this country?
I think it's certainly the case. You know, I guess the question becomes, you know, whether we're looking at a future in which, you know, certain types of government services, such as education, health, social services, whether more spending is going to go in that direction. That was a trend that certainly started with Affordable Care Act many, many years ago. That was a pretty large new program to expand government support of healthcare access. And so the question is whether we're going to see a situation where there's sort of bolstering of that side of things, or whether, you know, it's more of a zero-sum situation where certain services are curtailed in order to bolster spending in that area. But I don't think there's necessarily a consensus that that's the direction the United States is heading in. I think it's one of the things we're going to see a lot of debate over in coming years. And to some extent, our hand is going to be forced because of Social Security, which is a massive system with, you know, high levels of need and demand on the part of the baby boomers retiring. And so because of that system, we're going to see an expansion of spending there at a minimum.
I was going to say, I mean, people are living longer, so therefore there's surely going to be a strain put on the Social Security system going forward if all of us, you know, live longer lives.
Absolutely, which is a wonderful thing to have that, but just in, you know, longer life expectancy. But practically speaking, it's a question of how we best support people as that occurs and how we sort of bolster the programs that are meant to support people in their retirement.
And just briefly, you know, the national minimum wage, President Biden has said that he is potentially calling upon or may sort of like look further into a $15 national minimum wage. I mean, here in Connecticut, we're a little bit more fortunate. I believe currently it's around about $12 minimum wage here, and that will increase a dollar every year for the next few years. But in certain parts of the country, it's as low as $5.50.
That's very unfortunate. I mean, I think back to my first job many, many years ago, actually here in Connecticut a couple decades ago, and that I think I was earning right around that amount then. Yeah, and so there has been sort of a long debate over the minimum wage and its impact, the impact of increasing the minimum wage on businesses. You know, I think if we go back to this question of whether we live in a zero-sum world where, you know, if one person benefits, someone else must be losing, or whether we live in a world in which sort of the tide raises all boats, I think you can view the debate over the minimum wage through those two lenses. So one view, and it's a sort of a more traditional view of the minimum wage, is that if it's raised, it harms small businesses, it squeezes their profits. They won't be able to hire as many workers. And so ironically, you know, it can increase the unemployment rate. But the other view, and increasingly we have more and more evidence that the alternative view is what seems to hold, is that when you raise the minimum wage, it actually has a positive productivity effect on workers. So, you know, if they don't have to work three jobs just to make ends meet and they don't have so many worries about paying their bills, they can live healthier lives. And in fact, their productivity goes up in the workplace. And so as a consequence, it's actually not necessarily harmful to profits and to small businesses to see a minimum wage go up. And so we have more and more evidence that that's the case. And, you know, in addition to that, inequality and rising inequality in society can cause a lot of different problems like social instability, And clearly raising the minimum wage is something which addresses the issue of inequality.
Isn't part of that problem, though, and I get your point about, you know, harming smaller businesses, but large corporate businesses in this country have for many years, you know, taken advantage of the tax structure in this country. We hear stories all the time in the media, and obviously we have to be careful about how we consume those stories, but, you know, we hear about certain organizations that pay literally next to no tax. They have this huge buying power, and, you know, they source their products or their services from outside of the US, where the rate of pay is even less. Do we need to start looking at that situation and say, hey, enough is enough? We really do need to bring it back inside this country without cutting ourselves off from the outside world and leveling up the playing field?
Yeah, so I think one of the things another less important lesson we've learned about trade in particular is that there are a lot of great things when it comes to trade. In particular, you know, people do appreciate when they can afford more goods and services of different types, and those goods and services are more accessible because they're more reasonably priced, right? So that's the upside of trade. But the downside of trade, and it's a very significant downside, which has never been adequately addressed in the United States, is the fact that it dislocates jobs, particularly when you start to specialize in industries that have historically not been very significant in your country. So, for example, my campus is in a city called Willimantic, also known as Thread City. It was historically a town which relied upon textile production, clothing production, and a lot of that industry has moved abroad as a consequence of free trade. And that's been a huge challenge for that community. And not only that community, but a lot of these sort of mill towns throughout New England. Now, historically, or according to the way economists viewed these kinds of changes, people should reskill and shift to the industries which expand at the same time that increased trade takes place. But we know that that shift of skills and labor has been woefully inadequate. And again, this goes back to the role of government in society and the fact that government should be helping people develop skills for the industries which are expanding. That has not been part of the social contract we've seen in America as free trade has taken place. And so there are a lot of economists who are wrestling with the fact that there's been large communities which have been harmed as production has shifted across different sectors. And we really need to figure out how we're going to fix that. And I don't necessarily have the answer to that question, but I do believe supporting access to education and training is a key part of that equation.
Yeah, because I mean, just sort of like jumping on that little bit more, I mean, one of the biggest issues in this country, and it's been an ongoing issue, is the disparities between white and black wealth in this country, and also black and brown communities' ability to access things like education, jobs, and other things as well.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that is almost certainly the most important issue for America to address and sort of acknowledge in coming years. The racial wealth gap is the product of a sort of intentional discrimination in America through institutions like slavery, redlining, and imprisonment, which sort of differentially impacted communities of color. This hampered the ability to accumulate wealth over time, and it's sort of a persistent aspect of America which has not been adequately addressed up to this point, and it has all kinds of implications in terms of unequal opportunity, in terms of unequal health outcomes, and all sorts of things. I believe there's growing understanding and acknowledgement of this challenge. There's a really fascinating report by Citibank about the racial wealth gap, which I'd encourage people to take a look at. Just the fact that a very traditional bank, massive bank like Citibank, is writing, you know, 80-page reports on the issue of the racial wealth gap and talking about things they're going to do as a company to address it is encouraging, but the amount of work which needs to be done when it comes to the racial wealth gap is pretty incredible, and we shouldn't fool ourselves about how much time and effort it will require to address that issue.
Final question to you, Professor Cunningham, and thanks ever so much for your time today. Of course, we start 2021 with a new administration. What are some of the things that you hope to see happen in at least, you know, the next 4 years of this administration?
Well, I think right now, you know, we need to do everything we can to see our way out of the recession and pandemic that we're experiencing. You know, it's still a huge effort to vaccinate the population so that COVID is no longer a threat. And, you know, once we have reached that point where people are more comfortable and confident in their health and public health, I think that we're going to see sort of a very positive phase of things for America and the rest of the world. Although there will be many countries that are still struggling far longer than we are to vaccinate and get clear of the pandemic. I think that the big challenges for this new administration are how we get climate change policy in a place where that threat to the environment and countries around the globe is adequately addressed and we're prepared for that. I think we do need to figure out what we're going to do with the Social Security system. It's a massive program, which is going to need to adjust in some ways for the high levels of demand on it. And I do think that we have to look a lot more at issues like inequality by race and unequal access to healthcare and do better when it comes to those issues.
Well, it's going to be an interesting 4 years, and it's been great talking to Professor Brendan Cunningham of the Economics and Finance Department of Eastern Connecticut State University. Your insight is invaluable, and we look forward to speaking to you again in the future as obviously things continue to progress and we see the back of COVID-19 and we see how the US moves to some sort of normality, whether or not it's a new normal or whether or not it falls back into, you know, the status quo before COVID-19 actually occurred. But thank you ever so much for joining us on the podcast.
Great. Thanks so much, Brian.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently. Connecticut elected officials got an update from Electric Boat, one of the state's largest employers and manufacturers of the nation's submarines. Kevin Graney, president of Electric Boat, spoke at the legislative update event and said the future was looking bright for the submarine manufacturer.
With the award of the Virginia Block 5 and Columbia Build 1 construction contracts, we now have more work in front of us than at any other time in our history. Our contracted work, or what we refer to as our backlog, is currently $39 billion. That includes two of the 12 planned Columbia-class ballistic missile submarines and 19 Virginia-class submarines.
Although the news was generally good, with new multi-million dollar contracts being awarded to the company, U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal voiced his concern over the continued decline of companies that supply the defense industry.
They are hanging by a thread, many of them struggling to keep their doors open. We need to make sure they have available the PPP and other small business aids that are important to their survival, and that they have available also guarantees for future business that they can rely on.
Blumenthal said over the last several decades, the defense supply chain industry has dropped by 70%. Electric Boat said they were aware of the situation and are working to strengthen the supply chain, as well as adding up to 2,000 new jobs at EB alone this year. The Connecticut Department of Transportation has been awarded $450,000 from the Federal Transit Administration to install voice-activated ticket vending machines at 7 Connecticut Rail Shoreline East train stations. Rich Andreski is the Bureau Chief of Public Transportation for the state and says riders have asked them for ticket machines at the stations and they want to provide them with the latest in technology.
Instead of purchasing conventional machines that require customers to push buttons, we are moving forward on a program to bring voice-activated ticket vending machines to the line. It's a new technology, I guess much in the same way you would have and interact with Alexa in your kitchen. The idea is you can walk up to a machine and let the machine know exactly what ticket types you need.
The machines need to be designed and tested, and the DOT hope to have them installed at the stations by the end of 2022. Tickets for trains can also be purchased on your smartphone using the CT Rail eTix mobile app. In the Connecticut Examiner this week, the latest draft of Connecticut's Integrated Resources Plan, a semi-annual assessment of the state's electric supply needs and possible sources of energy supply, is being touted by the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection as the first to identify sources of supply to meet the state's goal of zero carbon electric generation by 2040, according to DEEP's Commissioner Katie Dykes. According to Dykes, Connecticut has already made a tremendous amount of progress towards achieving its 100% zero carbon electricity. Dykes told the Connecticut Examiner that in past years, the state's plan focused on the number of wind and solar energy projects that would need to be built to meet the state's renewable targets, but now as progress is being made towards procuring that capacity, the department is instead taking a broader view of some of the outside forces that could affect the state's path to carbon-free electric generation. In the day this week, New London Police Sergeant Cornelius Rogers, a veteran black officer with pending complaints of racial discrimination that motivated the city to conduct an independent investigation, has filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the city and the police department. Rogers alleges a pattern of systemic racial discrimination spanning his 17-year career at the department, where he claims he is unfairly targeted for discipline, the subject of biased investigations by white supervisors, and retaliated against when he has complained about it. It has resulted in a hostile work environment, he claims. Rogers has pending complaints with the State Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities, one of which he said provoked retaliation in the form of pepper spray being applied to the air ducts of his personal vehicle while parked outside the police department. An internal investigation into that complaint was inconclusive. In the Norwich Bulletin this week, a mum makes it to Norwich Hospital parking lot before giving birth. Staff at the William W. Backers Hospital were inside when they heard a commotion and calls to get the baby and the baby's out, realising someone was delivering a baby in the snowstorm. That someone was Caitlin Vakina of Lebanon, who, with help from her husband David, delivered Molly Jo, an 8-pound, 3-ounce baby girl, in the front seat of the couple's vehicle parked outside Norwich Hospital as a nor'easter continued to bear down on the region. The Vakina's journey started a little earlier in the morning when Caitlin was due to deliver on Sunday, woke up with cramping and pressure that evolved into contractions. She and her husband hopped into their car and made their way to Backers as snow continued to fall. Despite the unusual delivery and trip to the hospital, mum and baby are doing well. In the Middletown Press this week, minority communities that for generations have been targeted by law enforcement would receive major assistance to get into the marijuana business under a plan that Governor Lamont will consider as he proposes full legalization. The plan by a task force of lawmakers, community leaders and state officials marks the latest evolution of a thorny topic, equity and righting past injustices, in the multi-year campaign to legalize adult-use cannabis, which Lamont campaigned on in 2018. It includes a first-ever recommendation that for every 2 retail licenses awarded, at least 1 will be given in black and brown and lower-income communities. People convicted or imprisoned in the past for marijuana-related crimes would get preference under the proposals from the group, which includes cannabis advocates, members of underserved communities and clergy, as well as state economic and consumer protection officials. That's a way to give back to neighborhoods that have been disproportionately affected in what amounted to a failed 80-year war on marijuana use and sales, leaders of the group said. And in next week's Connecticut East This Week, we talk about the COVID vaccine and how it's being rolled out and its availability, and whether it's quicker and easier to get your shot from an independent pharmacy rather than trying to go through the state's complicated VAMS system and possibly ending up having your appointment cancelled because of supply issues. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott-Smith. Thank you for listening.